BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news from David McNeill.
Anglo-Pakistani relations have come under further strain after the head of Pakistan's intelligence agency cancelled a planned trip to London in protest at David Cameron's allegation that elements within the country are promoting the export of terror. His comments sparked outrage in Islamabad when he made them during his trip to India last week. News of the cancellation comes days before a three-day visit to Britain by the Pakistani president, Asif Ali Zardari. More than 800 people are now known to have died in flooding in northwest Pakistan. Dozens more have been killed in neighbouring Afghanistan after heavy monsoon rains triggered flash floods across the region. Military commanders say British and Afghan troops have faced only light resistance in the initial stages of Operation Tor-Shahzada. Soldiers from 1st Battalion, the Duke of Lancaster's regiment, are trying to clear the Taliban from a stronghold in the Nadi Ali district of Helmand province. The Ministry of Justice says it will vigorously defend any claim for compensation from the Soham murderer, Ian Huntley. He's suing the prison service on the grounds that it failed in its duty of care when he was attacked by another inmate in March this year. Huntley is serving a life sentence at Franklin Prison in County Durham for the murder of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman in 2002. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel is among thousands of people who've been mourning the 21 victims of last weekend's crush at a music festival in Duisburg. They've attended a memorial service which was shown on big screens in a football stadium and a dozen other churches across the city. A team of rowers is set to break a 114-year-old record for crossing the Atlantic from New York to the Isles of Scilly. If the four men arrive this afternoon, as expected, 44 days after they set off, they'll have beaten the record by 11 days. The weather for the rest of the day: sunny spells will become more widespread this afternoon, with light rain petering out. Tonight will be largely dry, with clear skies and rain confined to northern Scotland and southwest England towards dawn. And that's the BBC News at 1:02.
Time now for the early music show, and today Catherine Bart is on the road for an exploration of 18th century English music through the eyes of Thomas Gainsborough.
I'm in the heart of leafy Warwickshire, surrounded by agribusiness. That's 21st century speak for what I was brought up to call farming. It still is all fields round here, though, and for today's early music show we're visiting the 1750s, when England was still a largely agrarian culture, and the Industrial Revolution was just starting to make its presence felt. Wealth was mainly measured in acres of land when George II was on the throne, and political power and influence was in the hands of rich landowners. At the top of the social tree, the nobility, and just below them, the gentry. We're talking about slightly newer money here, although in our modern egalitarian age, it's always amusing to find that the origins of many of our grandest aristocratic dynasties are more recent and more raffish than one might suppose from a visit to the stately homes of England. Getting round the country was beginning to become easier, thanks to the burgeoning system of turnpike roads, and better communications go hand in hand with increased social mobility. Enter Thomas Gainsborough, beginning to make his way as a portrait painter as the 1750s began. Is perhaps best known for his portraits commissioned by the English gentry, in which his main task was to show his sitters to their best advantage. As a fellow artist remarked, Gainsborough knew mankind well and adapted himself to their humour when he thought it worthwhile. The sheer beauty and accomplishment of his work shows that he was no mere hack, and closer inspection shows him to be an astute and subtle artist with a keen sense of the age in which he lived. And for our purposes, a man with a great interest in the music of his time. So what am I doing in Shakespeare country, given that Gainsborough was a Suffolk man? Well, a leading authority on the artist lives in Warwickshire, Professor Michael Rosenthal of the University of Warwick, who's going to be guiding me through Gainsborough's relationship with music.
Music.
from John Hebden's Concerto for Strings No. 3 in E major, classic mid-18th century English music. The players were the violinists Angus Anderson and Helena Moroni, with Cantilena directed by Adrian Shepherd. Michael Rosenthal, tell me what Gainsborough means to you.
I find Gainsborough an extraordinarily interesting painter because he, along with all his colleagues, are having to find ways of surviving as artists during a time of very rapid change, when society is moving along, where more people who hadn't had money previously have money, need to spend it, where it's assumed that the acquisition of culture is one of the ways you show that you're justified in having money. And he's also a fabulous painter. He's very inventive when it comes to landscape, and he does things with portrait which are quite unlike anything anybody else is doing.
Now, our problem is that his work is so likeable and lovable that it's all over the world, and we can't actually, would that we could, have somebody bring us the portraits. In the meantime, we've got here a sort of virtual easel, and we're going to call up paintings for us to look at. And the first painting on the easel is a very famous, I don't know whether it's a lovable one, but it's a very famous double portrait, Mr. and Mrs. Andrews. Tell me about that.
Well, Andrews was somebody who, at the time this was painted, had yet to take over the estate that had been bought from him at a place called Bulmer, which is 2-3 miles south of Sudbury, where Gainsborough was based. He is going to set himself up as an improving landowner, or improving farmer, if you like. This much is evident, actually, from what Gainsborough has painted for him. You can see that the corn is in straight lines, which means the seed drill has been used, which means as well that Andrews is right up front when it comes to using the latest technology. His sheep are in enclosures. That, in its turn, lets you know that he understands that if you're going to breed sheep effectively, you want to make sure that the bloodline doesn't get affected by rogue rams, as might happen were they to be in open fields. He has a copse of oak trees. Oaks, of course, are the great patriotic tree because it's what you build ships from. And then behind it all, you get the great rolling Stour Valley landscape, Sudbury in the background, rather fabulous clouds, and Andrews and his wife Frances parked to the left of the picture. She is very young at this point. She's in her teens still. She's quite fashionably dressed. I suspect that Gainsborough, who is really trying to get his career on the road at this point, has less to do with what goes on in the painting than Andrews. I suspect that Andrews is saying, make sure you get this in. I want you to produce that bench. Make sure she's wearing her bonnet, and so on and so forth.
Continues and increasing. All joys be still.
Music by Thomas Arne from The Tempest. Honour, riches, marriage, blessing. The singer there was me, actually, with the Parley of Instruments directed by Peter Holman. And I hasten to add, Michael, I hardly ever allow that to happen, but I may be the only person who's recorded it. Now, let's talk about the young Gainsborough. You said he was 20 or 21 when he painted Mr. and Mrs. Andrews. What's his art background in Suffolk?
And the story is that when he was 13, he had spent so much time bunking off school in order to make little drawings in the landscape that these little drawings sufficiently impressed his father to send him down to London to start learning to paint, and that he spent a few very formative years learning at the St. Martin's Lane Academy, which had been revived by Hogarth in 1735, and presumably going to drink coffee at Slaughter's Coffee House, and generally having, I suspect, rather a good time. I think London in the 1740s, with such schemes as Vauxhall Gardens going on, you know, all these painters were involved in getting decorations into it and paintings into it. It must have been a bit like the jazz scene in New York in the late 1940s, when everything is happening and there's a lot of art going on and writers are there.
So young Gainsborough goes into Slaughter's Coffee House on St. Martin's Lane, and it's entirely plausible that Hogarth would have been enjoying
a
drink with Handel.
Yeah, he would have seen these people. Gainsborough in later life kept the company of musicians, as you know.
Although London's parks and gardens had first been opened to the public by King Charles I, later in the 17th century came the emergence into fashion of the pleasure garden, which provided beautiful surroundings, various entertainments and refreshments for a small entrance fee. The first to be created were those of Marylebone and Vauxhall, and others which came later included Cremorne, Ranelagh and Sadler's Wells. Possibly the most famous of all the pleasure gardens was Vauxhall, and a typical mid to late 18th century evening there could have been something like this. Visitors would enter the spacious grounds, which were beautifully landscaped and hung with lanterns, to promenade among the various attractions and sideshows, including firework displays and ballooning. In alcoves, pavilions and supper boxes, one could rest and take refreshments of various kinds while admiring Hogarth's decorations and listening to music. The main musical event of an evening at a pleasure garden was the concert, in the early years given from an open-air bandstand, but later in more opulent buildings which gave performers and audiences protection from the elements. Vauxhall had an indoor Rococo music room and an outdoor Moorish Gothic temple. All tastes were catered for, and concert programmes ranged from solo art songs to glees and choruses, from novelty orchestral items to full-scale symphonies. Nearly all the leading composers wrote music for the gardens, including William Boyce, James Hook, Thomas Arne, J.C. Bach, and of course, G.F. Handel. Handel's standing in the London musical world was marked at Vauxhall by a specially commissioned statue. The artist is Louis-François Roubilliac, who probably knew Handel, and it has a startling and unprecedented informality. Although the composer is depicted as Orpheus, plucking absently on a lyre, he's casually dressed, with a soft cap rather than a wig, and an open-necked shirt. This is Handel at home, with only one slipper on, and seated, cross-legged, on a pile of his own musical scores. At his feet, an oboe, a flute, and a little naked boy who is busy transcribing the sounds from Handel's lyre. It was the first life-size sculpture of a living artist, and it caused a sensation.
The Handel must have stood out as a remarkable thing, not least, of course, because you could compare the statue against the original, who was not yet dead. People marvelled at it in Vauxhall Gardens. It does to remember that we're tremendously sophisticated. We like to think we're tremendously sophisticated when we come to look at works of art. There were people at Vauxhall who had to be convinced that the statue was not the real person.
Music was of enormous importance, wasn't it, Michael, to gentrified England? And it's everywhere in Gainsborough's art.
It's quite interesting that we have on our conceptual easel at the moment a portrait he did in 1759 of William Wollaston, who was a friend of his in Ipswich. And Wollaston is shown pausing from playing his flute, a bit of sheet music on his leg, although when you inspect the sheet music, it doesn't translate as any kind of playable music. The portrait contrasts with another he'd made of the same sitter, where he's outdoors leaning on a stile, being every inch the country gentleman. So we get two notions of how his life was made up, going out into nature, being the country gentleman, investigating his estates, in a more private moment, playing music, reflecting on it, looking out to space. These were important portraits for Gainsborough because he is really pulling out the stops. You'll notice there's quite rich coloration in this. You've got this wonderful gold-braided scarlet waistcoat against a blue coat, so that you have coloristic harmonies existing at the same time as one can imagine Wollaston is playing musical harmonies. And that is the kind of analogy between the pictorial and the musical that Gainsborough would continue to make.
What I really like about this very likeable portrait is that despite the beautiful drapes and the splendour of his costume, because he also has white lace at the cuffs, and I think that's satin lining to this splendid coat, he looks entirely convincing. The way he's holding the flute is utterly plausible. He's not just posing with it.
The point is that Gainsborough himself played everything he could, including the oboe, which apparently he made a ghastly noise. So he would have known exactly how these instruments would be handled and doesn't have to think twice about representing it. This is a convention of male portraiture where the public figure is shown in a private moment. You'll get it with other painters as well. You'll get the curtain swooshing back. There'll be a table on which there are things like books. They'll be shown in a reflective moment, quite often with books and thinking. But in Wollaston's case, pausing from playing his flute for a moment before getting back to it. And consequently, it's implied that he is a virtuous man, and his love for music and his capacity to play music are signs of that virtue.
Thank you.
Just the sort of repertoire that William Wollaston might have enjoyed playing. It's from Geminiani's A Treatise of Good Taste in the Art of Music. That's Old Bob Morris. And it was played by Brian Berryman on the flute, Axel Wolf on the lute, and Eckhart Cooper on the harpsichord. Michael, Gainsborough's love of music must have started very young when he was back in Sudbury. What sort of musical life was there available for him there?
Sudbury, I don't know so much about. Once he got to Ipswich, there was, of course, Gibbs and the musical club. He has the rather fabulous anecdote about that, which he retails to Garrick in a letter. He tells a story of somebody who said that claimed they could read at sight and then in face of the music couldn't, and said, well, I never said I could read at first sight. So Gainsborough would have played around with Gibbs and people like that in Ipswich before, of course, moving to Bath in a far more rarefied musical atmosphere. There's an interesting quote from William Jackson of Exeter, who was himself a composer. This is from his book, The Four Ages, published in 1798, when he tells us that Gainsborough's profession was painting, and music was his amusement, yet there were times when music seemed to be his employment and painting his diversion, which tells you all you need to know about how keen he was on music. And Jackson, who isn't as nice as he might have been about Gainsborough, seems to wish to put across the idea that Gainsborough thought that the capacity to produce a great sound actually resided in the instrument. So he writes about how Gainsborough was anxious to possess Giardini's violin. In fact, I suspect that Gainsborough, as somebody who just liked things, you know, he's a painter, he might also have appreciated the fact that a beautiful musical instrument is a thing that is worth actually just looking at as well as playing.
Thank you.
Echoes of Gainsborough's musical life in Ipswich, music by his friend Joseph Gibbs. That was the aria from his Sonata No. 1 in D minor, played by Elizabeth Walfisch on violin, Richard Tunnicliffe, the cellist, and the harpsichordist was Paul Nicholson. If Gainsborough had remained in Suffolk, I think we can say that he wouldn't be the artist we know today. It was limiting for him, wasn't it?
One of the problems is that once you've had your portrait painted, you're not probably going to want to have it painted twice, so it's a kind of one-off thing. And although there were cultivated people around Suffolk, as we know, Gainsborough's market dried up, he couldn't sell enough landscapes, and therefore he made a very carefully planned decision to move to Bath. Carefully planned because he made a reconnaissance trip in 1758, which proved to him that it would supply him with a constant flow of sitters. And when he did get there, not only was he trading on his reputation at taking a very accurate likeness, but it also developed what was called a hatching style of painting, a style of painting where the paint goes down in great clusters of short, sharp strokes, which themselves don't describe the object so much as intimate it or suggest it, so that, again, when you're at a proper viewing distance, you see this mess of paint form itself into the image of the face of somebody that you recognise. And consequently, once he gets to Bath, working at the top end of a complex artistic market, Bath is really London, but in Somerset, he gets a reputation very quickly. His prices begin to go up, and very soon he is painting top-end sitters.
And among his friends in Bath are always musicians, Thomas Linley Sr., the founder of the great dynasty, and in particular the two wonderful portraits of Carl Friedrich Abel. This one that we're going to look at now seems to me to have much more to say in it. There are wonderful drapes. He's sitting on a very fine chair. He has a gold brocade waistcoat. He is writing something. His viola da gamba, casually but utterly plausibly, resting informally on his left leg.
This is a phenomenal portrait in every respect. It is one of a cluster with which Gainsborough announced his return to centre stage. Gainsborough had not exhibited since 1774. Consequently, this is announcing a triumphant return. By this point, Reynolds has been in front of students of the Royal Academy, advocating the great style, advocating line over colour, coming out with such things as though it be allowed that elaborate harmony of colouring, a brilliancy of tints, a soft and gradual transition from one to another, present to the eye what an harmonious concert of music does to the ear. It must be remembered that painting is not merely a gratification of the sight. And Gainsborough is actually saying, actually, painting is a gratification of the sight and a great deal else. The colouring, the great green of the curtain, the red of the chair back, the gold of the waistcoat, the blue of the lining of the coat, has to remind you of Venetian painting, which is sensual, which is harmonious, and with which analogies with music are traditionally made. So the colouring is entirely appropriate to a portrait of a musician who's laid his instrument almost casually across his thigh, and who, as you pointed out, paused from writing for a moment. And Gainsborough is learned, but he never likes to present himself as being learned, because the kind of prototype for the image that you're seeing is actually a saint who is shown at the moment of receiving divine inspiration. So the divine inspiration that Abel is getting, presumably, is the divine inspiration that is going to lead him to compose even greater music. The pen has stopped for the moment, but it will carry on. Of course, once again, this is somebody who most people would know. He was extremely prominent on the music scenes of both Bath and London. Therefore, an exhibition going public would have been able to vouch for whether or not this was a good likeness, and presumably it was.
I think Abel himself would have been very pleased. He has finely formed hands and terrific legs.
Yeah, he has a very nicely turned calf, which was a prerequisite in those days,
viol player Suzanne Heinrich playing that vivace for six-string bass viol by Carl Friedrich Abel. We haven't yet seen a portrait of a lady, and the next portrait up on our virtual easel is of Anne Ford, a most unusual and provocative young woman, and she is depicted with her English guitar. Was Anne Ford. She was a well-born young lady, well-educated too, speaking several languages, and inconveniently for her father, she was a talented musician. She had a fine singing voice, and she played the English guitar, viola da gamba, and the musical glasses. Tired of performing only to her peers in private, she resolved to share her gifts with a wider public. Unthinkable, thundered her father, who went so far as to have her arrested twice when she attempted to do so. The singing wasn't a problem. There were plenty of well-respected professional female singers around. No, it was her announcement that she would play a solo on the viol da gamba. Now that was an instrument reserved for men to play. But she did, in the end, give a couple of public concerts. Anne's boldness also brought her a successful marriage to Sir Philip Thicknesse, Gainsborough's mentor. And thus she came to be painted by Gainsborough in a controversial pose, as Mrs. Mary Delaney wrote on first seeing the portrait in 1760. A most extraordinary figure, handsome and bold. But I should be very sorry to have anyone I loved set forth in such a manner. Gainsborough showed Anne Ford holding her guitar, entirely acceptably. Women were usually painted in domestic surroundings doing something appropriate and seemly, like plucking at a guitar or knotting. But the shocking thing was her pose. As a contemporary conduct book described it, she is crossing her legs, above the knee, a masculine freedom, for such a free posture unveils more of a masculine disposition than sits decent upon a modest female.
The issues here were, I guess, decorum and propriety. Was it proper for a woman to perform in public? And Gainsborough capitalises on that in this quite extraordinary portrait. It plays an important role for him professionally in Bath, because you've quoted Mrs. Delaney. The reason she was able to see it was because it was taking pride of place in his painting room. So when you went on a visit to Gainsborough's painting room, you would see and recognise, for, as you can tell, she's flirty, extremely pretty, the portrait of somebody who had caused a quite extraordinary scandal. And Gainsborough builds some of that into it. For example, she has got her English guitar, but that could normally be allowed into a portrait when someone was playing it, which she is not. And I don't think it's far-fetched to see, if you like, a certain element of phallic symbolism in this, that her deciding to take to the stage, in other words, to take a male role, is indicated here as being somehow masculine. But Gainsborough does lots of things. For example, she isn't in a masculine pose only because her legs are crossed, but also because the way that the elbow is crocked and her head is resting on the back of her hand denotes thinking, cogitation, a capacity for abstract thought, so that she is allowed by Gainsborough to occupy a sphere that's also occupied by creative men. But he builds naughtiness into it too, because the wonderful red curtain doesn't cover the whole of the background. It reveals a Viola da Gamba, and one wonders who is going to come in to play that. And one is also put in mind of 17th century Dutch traditions, where music lessons and music making could also be symbolic of other activities between men and women. This is one of the pictures that is done immediately after he's been carrying on this intense study of Van Dyck at Wilton. And when you go to Cincinnati, where it is, and you see the actual work, you'll be struck by the enormous brilliance with which he's rendered the textures of fabrics. It's interesting here to note that his sister was a milliner, also based in Bath, so Gainsborough knew about stuffs as well as he knew about music. Consequently, you get a fantastic contrast between the silvery sheen of the dress and the deep red of the curtain, along with rather beautiful little yellow ribbons here and there to offset the colouring, which would again, as with Arbel, I suspect, indicate coloristic harmonies as being analogous to musical harmonies. But this was a high-risk woman who had caused a scandal which had been of great public interest. This is painted in 1760, which is about the time of the development of a real celebrity culture in Britain, when people begin to get famous for being famous and get featured in caricatures, pamphlets and so forth. Ford features in pamphlets, those she's written herself, those that are written about her. There's a crude caricature based on this painting in one of these pamphlets. And consequently, Gainsborough is not only doing something very interesting and allowing her to be presented in her own terms, because if you were to make pictorial connections, it would be with the Handel statue. Consequently, anybody who had been looking at recent art would understand precisely the narratives which are built into this, and knowing Ford's story would understand as well quite how appropriate these were.
Do you reckon that Gainsborough was greatly in sympathy with Anne Ford?
I think Gainsborough came into life without prejudices. He probably recognised that she actually was supremely good at playing music and at singing. He seems to lack, if you like, prejudice as to what you should and what you should not be doing when it comes to the various roles that men and women could play at this period. Thank you.
Anthony Halstead with the Hanover Band, playing J.C. Bach, Johann Christian Bach, the London Bach. Looking at Johann Christian Bach, the penultimate portrait on our virtual easel today, there's a flash of bright blue kingfisher waistcoat, but the subtlety of his coat, I think, is very beautiful, sort of mushroom grey with a bit of pink in it. That's very underdressed compared with some of the other gentlemen we've seen.
And the thing that I always find interesting about this is the very flash ring that he's wearing on his little finger.
Yes, large hands, one holding music, lace cuffs, and a hand sitting just casually on the other arm with this splendid buckle-duster.
But you see, I mean, he's a man about town. This is an era when men weren't afraid to be dandies and to dress up in brightly coloured clothing, in his case, not brightly coloured clothing except for the waistcoat. I think you're getting all this into a portrait that doesn't have the kind of loaded content that the Arbel did or the Anne Ford before that.
It is giving you what I suspect must have been a wonderful likeness as a real person. J.C. Bach was famous for writing keyboard works, but he doesn't need to be shown at a keyboard. It is enough that he is holding some music, which we don't need to be able to identify, but I don't think we could we?
Although that in itself is interesting, because I mentioned this convention of the interior portrait where the public man sits in private retirement, often looking at books, acquiring wisdom. Here, a piece of music is shown to be on a par with this. Therefore, the importance of music as a cultural activity, as a public activity, is brought home very strongly by the way Gainsborough places the sheet music within a particular portrait format.
This is a man of taste and cultivation and refinement, and if he regards music as a symbol of himself, that's good enough for Gainsborough and it's good enough for all of us.
Absolutely.
Finally, we're going to one of the tenderest double portraits that Gainsborough ever did. It's a portrait of the Lindley sisters, 18-year-old Elizabeth and 14-year-old Mary, who were two of the 12 children of Thomas Lindley of Bath. And he was the sire of quite a musical dynasty because seven of his 12 children grew up to enjoy musical careers, although some of them didn't live very long. Elizabeth married Richard Brinsley Sheridan, and Mary married another playwright, Richard Tickell, and they both died too young.
It's an absolutely extraordinary picture because, firstly, Elizabeth, who is standing with her left arm holding on to the neck of a guitar while the right wrist is draped over it, gazes into space, and Mary, her sister, who is seated, appears almost in the act of turning to gaze directly at us. Gainsborough would have known these girls. He was friendly with the Lindleys in Bath. He would have heard both of them sing. He'd have been acquainted with their histories. And it's interesting that the pink picture was being painted at the time that Elizabeth was eloping to France with Richard Brinsley Sheridan. Something of that rather turbulent history might be getting in built in here with her rather wistful gaze out into space and the fact that she is standing as against sitting, because normally you would have expected to see the two girls sitting with some rather more harmonious activity taking place between them.
And also the guitar, which is a long Spanish-type guitar, is not wholly seen. In fact, it's almost incidental. It's very much masked by Mary's dress.
What I find quite striking is the colouring of their frocks, because Mary is dressed in a earth-coloured frock, a kind of goldy-brown, which makes a part of the scene, almost part of the landscape, if you like, whereas Elizabeth is wearing a much more aerial-hued frock insofar as it's a species of light blue with a lot of white lace around and about.
And it's a grander frock altogether,
isn't it? It's a grander frock, but it's also the colour of the sky. It's the colour of air, if you like, and it might again carry within itself a kind of allusion to the flight that she has undertaken with Sheridan, and, of course, which means that her career as a singer, whom people such as Gainsborough can deeply enjoy, is to all intents and purposes over, because Sheridan won't allow her to sing in the future. And again, the artist will have known of this.
The music that we're going to end with is by Thomas Lindley Jr., who was an exact contemporary of Mozart, born in 1756, and drowned in his 20s, so a great loss to English and, well, late 18th century music. We're going to end, well, first of all, with thanks, Michael Rosenthal, to you for giving me a really wonderful afternoon here in Warwickshire. And music by Thomas Linley, words by Elizabeth Linley from the cantata In Yonder Grove. It's the air tune Philomel. The singer is Julia Gooding with the Parley of Instruments, directed by Paul Nicholson.
the air Tune Philomel from the cantata In Yonder Grove by Thomas Linley Jr. It was sung by Julia Gooding with the Parley of Instruments, directed by Paul Nicholson. Today's Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott and produced by Chris Wines. Well, this is BBC Radio 3. It's 2 o'clock, and now we have a second opportunity to hear a compact version of last Monday's Proms Chamber Music recital in Cadogan Hall. Unfortunately, the Finnish string quartet Meta 4 had to withdraw as their cellist was taken ill, and their place was taken at short notice by the Navarra Quartet. And they gave us Debussy, Haydn and Schumann, starting with piano music played by Francesco Piemontesi. We'll hear four preludes by Debussy, The Terrace of Spectators by the Light of the Moon, The Hills of Anna Capri, The Girl with the Flaxen Hair, and What the West Wind Saw.